I'm gonna sit right down and write myself a letter and make believe it came from you.
The 2011 Harlem Jazz Shrines Festival is a week-long series of concerts that celebrate the clubs and venues that once made Harlem the epicenter for jazz. In addition to looking back on this golden era, this year's inaugural festival is committed to the present with performers like Jason Moran, who'll be appearing along with Michelle Indigicello, I always have problems with that name, tomorrow and Saturday at the Fats Waller Dance Party, Small's Paradise Tribute at the Harlem Stage Gatehouse. It is with great pleasure that I welcome the wonderful Jason Moran back to our show today. Hi.
Good to see you again.
So whose idea was it to create the Harlem Jazz Shrine Festival?
You know, I'm not sure of that genesis. I got on board because the Harlem Stage Gatehouse was a part of the organizing of it. And so I was just happy to be on board for them committing to kind of not reinvigorating, but kind of bringing just the word jazz in Harlem, like, back into the public persona, like, in kind of in a larger way, even though there's always great jazz in Harlem.
Although it's surprising no one came up with this idea until now. Yeah. But besides the Apollo Theater, how many of the original jazz shrines are still open?
Well, there's still Minton's Playhouse is still there.
But not the original Minton's Playhouse, is it?
It's the same one.
Uh-huh. Although it closed down for many years.
It closed down and then it opened again. And so there's jam sessions happening there. There's still people playing at the Lennox Lounge. There's Showman's on 125th. And there's still, I think, St. Nick's Pub might be closed right now, but hopefully it's reopening soon. So there's always some haunts uptown to go to.
And there was Small's Paradise, which is also part of your tribute.
Right.
That was once owned by Will Chamberlain, wasn't it? When he had enough time away from the ladies to actually go to a club.
I'm sure club owners have lots of stories.
But this city used to have so many great jazz clubs on 52nd Street for many years, and there was Birdland on Broadway, a half a dozen important ones in the Village. Were the ones in Harlem special?
Well, I mean, for community it is. You know, to maintain nightlife in parts of the city usually kind of begins to generate certain types of sounds in parts of the city too. So like the Bronx, of course, is known for hip-hop, or Queens is known for hip-hop, but not the Village. The Village is known for other things. So Harlem and jazz, especially during the Renaissance, so people like roaming 125th Street and all these clubs is kind of part of the lore for me as a kind of a, I mean, now I'm starting to say I'm a New Yorker, but for moving from Houston, it was important to then live uptown and go to Manhattan School of Music and then remain living uptown because of its jazz piano heritage of all the people who lived and played uptown, James P. Johnson, Art Tatum, Duke Ellington,
Thelonious Monk. The Lincoln Center area.
Yeah, so there's enough people, you know, that kind of roam the neighborhood that I'm always claiming Harlem.
Well, Fats Waller is another example.
Yes.
Did you choose to participate in this?
It was.
Is he a favorite?
Of course, he's a favorite. Also, as a student of James P. Johnson, like a one who has taken James P. Johnson's thing and kind of refined it into this kind of like very glittery approach to the instrument, whereas James P. Johnson really would stomp with his left hand.
He played stride piano, and Fats did an updated version. Now, what is stride exactly? You don't see too many people other than Marcus Roberts doing that today.
Oh, there are a lot. There are a lot that are doing it. I'm glad that Marcus is stereotyped because that's very cool for him. But now, stride piano is where the left hand is kind of bouncing, bonk, chink, bonk, chink, ga-dung, ga-chink, dun.
It's creating a kind of a syncopation.
Yeah, and it's also the era of stride pianos when pianists were their own bands and playing parties. So the piano as a party instrument was kind of big and booming back then with the player pianos, et cetera.
Well, a Fats Waller dance party sounds like fun.
Yeah.
Was that your idea?
Well, you know, if I have to consider a musician as important as Fats Waller, and also in a time that was kind of as interesting for America, the Great Depression, et cetera, it's then... But that he had all this joy and all these people moving to his music, then I thought in a contemporary setting, then what is it to re-look at his music and add a different vibe underneath it to make me want to dance to it?
You know? Because it's hard to imagine a John Coltrane or Ornette Coleman dance party.
It can be done. I mean, the thing is...
With adjustments.
Yeah, well, everything has to be adjusted. I mean, it's adjusted even if I'm going to sit down and play Fats Waller's music just in my jazz trio, the bandwagon, it's going to be adjusted.
And we're going to hear... Maybe we should listen to a little clip from rehearsal.
Sure.
Okay? We have something from The Joint Is Jumpin'.
Okay.
Yeah. Switch over to organ. Well, he used to play organ as well. But
right.
You think Fats would recognize
the thing that
as a tribute?
Well, yeah. Well, that's the rehearsal. But I think he would.
You do get to the melody at
some
point.
Yeah, we do. Yeah. Michelle sings The Joint Is Jumpin'. Yeah, she sings all that. But, you know, like also, you know, I'm from the 80s and where, you know, I still think of as just an excerpt of a phrase, a piano phrase, is as potent to me as the entire thing. So the things that I'm playing, but that for me is, that's Fats Waller. It's just totally Fats.
Well, he wrote a lot of songs that have entered into the American songbook, but the only one I can think of that continues to be a jazz standard, a lot of modern players like to play, is the Jitterbug Waltz.
Right.
Why that of all the songs?
That's interesting. I'm not sure either. And Jitterbug was one of those tunes that I heard Fats's version, then I heard randomly almost Eric Dolphy's version of it. And then when I
Clifford
was in,
Brown and yeah. Matt Roach did a version.
And then when I was playing with Greg Osby's band, kind of one of my first moments, then he also played Jitterbug Waltz. And I remember there was a moment when playing this song that I thought I had done everything that I thought I could do to it. And I was frustrated, and I talked to my wife and said, I don't know about this song anymore. She said, you know, if you don't like it, then you need to make it better for yourself. And then I immediately started saying, okay, well, then maybe I can reorganize this while I'm performing it. And so when we played Jitterbug Waltz, it's not a waltz anymore. It's in four, and it's like a slow jam, almost like, you know, like a Mary J. Blige song. And so it's really, you know, these things kind of like take on different shapes and forms, and hopefully the audience will want to move to them. That's the most important part of this.
Well, it is one of the jazz standards today, but are you going to be playing all of the songs that we associate with Fats Waller? Honeysuckle Rose,
right.
Amos Behavin. I'm going to sit down, write down and write myself a letter. I got a feeling I'm falling.
Yeah.
One of my favorites, Your Feet's Too Big.
Feet's Too Big is in there. Yeah.
Squeeze Me.
Yeah.
And we heard you do a little bit of The Joint Is Jumpin'.
Joint Is Jumpin', Shake of Araby. You know, like...
What do you think has made them so popular? Partly, some of it is because he had such a wonderful sense of humor.
Yeah, I think that's part of it. I mean, you know, like there was a thing that I am still perplexed by is very popular entertainers with extreme amounts of talent, like extreme. Like he's a phenomenon at the piano. There's no mistaking this. Nowadays, it's very hard to find these extreme amounts of talent in the very, very popular entertainers. So Fats Waller is, you know, like Duke Ellington is like, you know, very elegant, very full of style. I mean, he drank a lot of whiskey, of course. But
and died young as a result.
Yeah, 39 is a crazy age to die at for such a kind of prolific person. But it's piano players also have a different kind of place in kind of popular culture, so that even a person like Liberace is popular as a piano player. And so Fats kind of fits this maybe I can arrive.
But Fats does have something that most others don't. He also sang. Unlike Nat King Cole, he didn't give up playing piano.
Yeah.
Nat was a great pianist first.
Amazing, right.
And Fats started as a jazz pianist who then sang.
Yeah. And the great thing is he could still play and sing. I can't do this. I can't my brain doesn't work the way to put words and motion together. It just doesn't. So I'm always marveling at what Fats does.
You don't hear the words? Ben Webster used to say that he always heard the lyrics while he was playing.
Oh, well, something. Hearing the lyrics is one thing. I'm saying singing them.
Uh-huh.
And playing.
In tune.
Yeah, in tune, right. My wife is like cringes when I try to sing.
Well, he supposedly, it's estimated anyway, that he either wrote or co-wrote 400 compositions, but of course his name isn't on a lot of them.
Yeah.
Because of his alcohol problems, did he just give them away or sell them for very little?
I mean, this is a case for a lot of people. I mean, even say, you know, Thelonious Monk, his composition Round Midnight has many other composers' names on it.
Well, he had to do that just simply to get Cootie Williams, for example, because that's the only way he could get it recorded.
Yeah,
that was one of the scandals of the record business.
Yes, and these scandals continue today. I mean, there's interesting things that go on with performers and how they deal with how to kind of continue to hold a legacy within their catalog. That was a very early lesson to me from Greg Osby about how to keep your catalog. It was like before I even had a publishing company, it was like you need to keep it because people will want to take it, even though and so our examples are.
I mean, if you write something that other people want to play, the next thing you know, they're claiming writing credit.
Yeah, and it's a common practice. And unfortunately for people like Fats Waller, they get kind of washed into this place because their names don't appear on the pieces that they kind of really contributed to kind of the American sound, you know.
My guest is Jason Moran, who will be performing tomorrow night and Saturday night at the Harlem Stage Gatehouse. Where is that located exactly?
That's on 135th and Convent uptown, Brighton.
There are two sets each night, 9 o'clock and 11 o'clock. And if you want more information, you can go to our show page at WNYC.org. It's interesting that you brought up Thelonious Monk. I was thinking about people not dancing to jazz after modern jazz became the standard. But Monk, when things were really going well, he would stand up from the piano bench and do a little dance on the stage.
Right, right. And I remember seeing this when I was like a teenager and thinking, okay, he's bizarre. And then once I started playing music with musicians who were greater than I, and I started to feel what maybe he was understanding about, and it also makes me want to get up from the piano and then move. When I play with Charles Lloyd is like always walking and dancing on the stage. So it's movement is like a big part of kind of, you know, this weird thing happens with jazz, like, and people go to clubs, and if somebody starts squirming in their seats, you know, as they're listening to the music and starting to move their head, then all of a sudden they're like ostracized, you know, by the fellow patrons. Like, oh, can you stop? You're distracting how I'm listening, which is the most ludicrous thing to ever ask of someone.
Well, it's hard to stop tapping your foot if something is swinging.
Yeah, and so this, you know, this party, you know, though it's less, you know, it's all under the umbrella of jazz, but it's really for those people who are frustrated, who go to jazz clubs and just want to move and don't have the space to.
What is your assessment of the state of jazz today? I mean, this is a ridiculous question to ask, but it seems to me that New York still has some vibrant clubs, although they are bringing more and more acts that might always not have been called jazz in the past. Mm-hmm. But most other cities have pretty much given up their jazz clubs.
Yeah, well, you know, the good thing that has been happening is, I mean, it's not only here, but there are very strong scenes throughout Europe. And they are really kind of beginning to claim the stake of, like, no, we own jazz now.
Europe and Japan have kept jazz alive.
Well, I won't say they keep it alive. I'm saying musicians keep it alive all over the world. And in New York, it's still the most vital vitamin for jazz is to come to this city to really understand, okay, what makes Dizzy Gillespie sound like this if he lives in New York? Or what makes Dexter Gordon?
Well, he lived in New Jersey.
He lived in, darn.
To New Yorkers, that's very important.
Yeah, it is. You ain't lying. So what makes people sound this way who come to the city? And I think most people who want to continue to play the music feel like they have to come here. But But it's but now it's being owned by the world, though. It's not just the New York thing. And so I've always been shocked traveling around the world, just kind of how vibrant the scenes are everywhere else.
Well, there are schools throughout the country where there are bands, and right. They compete. In fact, we recently talked to some people who are in the big Duke Ellington right. contest every year that Wynton Marsalis right. Has organized. So it's still being played.
Right.
But I wonder why kids don't switch over from rock to jazz the way they did when I was young.
No money. That's a big reason. I mean, you know, part of the thing people think is there's no example of like jazz being anything but a beggar's sport. I'm talking about contemporary examples. There are very few. So people don't think that it's necessarily a form that will achieve them any necessarily fame or anything. And so they decide to try to do whatever they decide to do. But, you know, that's their problem, not mine.
Well, we want to go out with a little bit of Fats Waller. We're going to play Oyster in My Stew, mm-hmm. which is one of his wonderful compositions, mm-hmm. and he just performed it so well. Jason Moran will be doing those songs with the help of Michelle.
Indege Ocello.
Indege Ocello.
Okay. Indege Ocello.
We were hoping that Jason would be doing the singing himself tomorrow and Saturday at the Fats Waller Dance Party at the Smalls Paradise Tribute at the Harlem Stage Gatehouse. And performances are at 9 and 11 o'clock. And Jason, as always, it's been a great pleasure having you on the show.
Thank you.
So let's listen to a little Fats Waller. Our ticket information is on our show page. I forgot to mention that at WNYC.org.
I'm convinced, completely, fully, firmly convinced, you're the only one.